you see these people on Twitter, and I'm guilty of it, that say like, hey, you need to have money to make money. You need to own a business. You got to have leverage. You know how to get rich without getting lucky. You see all these things in mainstream media about entrepreneurship. And unfortunately, there's a lot of bad things about entrepreneurship that people don't see. You know, I was in a very bad mental state a couple times in the storage business when my employees were driving box trucks down highways in Boston, and they went on the wrong road and on, you know, Soldier Field Drive, and they ripped the roof off of our brand new truck when we didn't have any money in the bank to pay for the fix. And same day, another guy put gasoline in a diesel fuel engine and blew a motor up on a truck that we rented, and we got a $6,000 bill. And I was in those two trucks were out broken down, full of people's stuff, and the customers were calling us, and they were, and I had a mental breakdown on the side of the road. I was crying. I was in a shitty warehouse in Medford, Massachusetts, having a breakdown on a sidewalk, and I wanted to just call my mother and cry in her arms that day.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's episode is with Nick Huber, aka Sweaty Startup. He's a real estate entrepreneur, self-storage owner, and operator. His commercial real estate portfolio is approaching $30 million in assets, and he's built a name for himself by championing sweaty startups, aka unsexy businesses. Nick has built a 100,000 person following on Twitter by transparently breaking down concepts in the real estate game and sharing lessons learned from his time in business. This convo split up into two parts. After listening to part one, you'll understand the equation for getting wealthy in real estate, the difference between creating and growing wealth, categories of real estate beyond what the 99% of people invest in, from self-storage to cemeteries and tiny homes. You'll learn all about niche opportunities with less competition, how real estate investors can make millions of dollars and legally pay almost zero in income taxes with depreciation, bonus depreciation, and 1031 exchanges. We go through Nick's unique approach to finding upside from day one and why 100% occupancy rates aren't always a good thing. In part two, Behind the Mind, which starts at around 47 minutes, we discuss tribes, relationships, and what truly matters in life, growing up, dealing with bullying and insecurities, choosing who you compete with, unique ways to connect with aging parents, why having kids is underrated, and the importance of a supportive spouse. Nick told me this was his favorite interview he's ever done, and it was a highlight convo for me too. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. If you did, we'd love to hear from you on Twitter. Share this out and tag us and tell us what you enjoyed the most. I'm at BZady and he's at Sweaty Startup. As always, you can catch all of these on youtube.com/CreatorLabFM if you prefer the visual. Now let's get straight into the show. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So man, look, you've been absolutely killing the game right now on Twitter. That's how we got connected, like a lot of people I've had on the show recently. We'll go into a little bit of your epic threads in the second half of the show. Today's conversation is really going to be focused on, you know, the game of real estate, which you've been working in for some time now, and you've been sharing out so many detailed examples and case studies and concepts that I've been incredibly impressed. So we're going to try to unpack some of that today. And then the second half, we're going to go into kind of the philosophy of the sweaty startup, what it represents, and dig into some of these amazing threads. So
I can talk about this stuff for hours, so I'm excited.
Well, yeah, let's keep going until we need to stop, man. So just to kick us off, like, could you give us a little bit of a background on who you are and what you've been working on for the last few years?
Yeah, I'm 31 years old. I live in Athens, Georgia. My real estate portfolio is in upstate New York. I grew up in southern Indiana on a farm. I went to a high school of 85 people, and then went to college in Ithaca, New York to run track and field at Cornell. Met my business partner, had a great experience up there in Ithaca. Senior year, started a small service business, and that's kind of where the sweaty startup comes in. I'm really passionate about service-based, low-risk entrepreneurship as a way to kind of jumpstart, launch your career. We started a company called Storage Squad back in 2011 when we were juniors in college. And out of school, we grew that business slowly over time until about 5 years in. We were at 25 schools doing a couple $1 million a year in revenue. We had saved some cash, and at that point, got started in the real estate game and built a self-storage facility from the ground up in upstate New York. And then the rest is history. We operated that thing for a while. I'm sure we'll dive into the portfolio and the deals, but now I'm in the self-storage business, and we have 12 properties that we own right now and another 10 in the pipeline to close on in the next couple months. So we've proved the concept, and we are scaling up now at this point.
For people who don't know, like, self-storage, that if we were looking at real estate from a high level, that's there's normally like residential and commercial, and this is within commercial, right? So
yeah, everybody thinks of real estate as, you know, single family homes, multifamily homes, but there's so much more to it. And commercial real estate has a lot of different asset classes as well, like industrial, medical office, you know, nursing homes, RV parks, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities. And the thing about commercial real estate is that it's a lot more like a small business. You operate it, you get customers, you sign leases, you run it like a small business. So I was naturally drawn to an area where I have a little bit more control over how much money an asset makes for me. So yeah, we chose self-storage, and it's just like any other piece of real estate, except, you know, in a million-dollar facility, we may have 100 or 200 or 300 different tenants. So we're kind of spread out among a lot of different customers.
Tell me why you landed into that space. Why did you pick self-storage versus what else was out there?
I'm of the camp that taking the path of least resistance is the best way to get wealthy. When everybody's looking in one direction, everybody's looking at one thing, in my opinion, that may not be the best place to make money because that's where the competition is. So I was looking for an asset class. My partner and I were looking for an asset class where we could compete really well with non-sophisticated operators. And you look at the self-storage business, the average age of a self-storage owner, this is a wild guess, but I'm going to say 60 years old is the average age, and they're owner operators. And many, many, many of them operate like it's 1985, meaning fax machines, answering phone calls, signing paper leases, 5 o'clock, the day's over, they're keeping handwritten ledgers. So, you know, we were after an asset class. Hey, where can we come in? We can innovate a little bit. I love innovation. You know, I talk bad about it a lot on Twitter, but I love little small steps that can make things a lot better. And self-storage was one of those areas where it was ripe for innovation. Some software was coming out that made it really efficient. We could cut costs, we could drive revenue, and we could basically find assets that were a lot more valuable to us than they were to the current owners. And it made for a beautiful situation to buy and scale a portfolio.
You talked about this on Twitter recently. And I'll definitely recommend people follow you right now if they're on their phone listening. Pull out your Twitter app and that is Sweaty Startup. And we'll share that in the show notes, obviously, as well. Definitely, I'm not just saying this because you're on the show. You've been my top five followers in the last year, especially these amazing threads we'll dive into. But you talked about like who you're competing with. And this is something I spoke to Andrew Wilkinson about a couple episodes ago. He's got Tiny, a portfolio that buys, you know, he's got more than 30 companies now in the hundreds of millions in revenue. And he talks about competing, like fishing where the fish are. And I heard you talk about something similar there, which was, do you want to compete with someone who's got a fax machine in 2021 or, you know, a Stanford grad with a bunch of VC money with a, you know, going into this new market and doing crazy stuff in it. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel any like disdain or, like, I don't know what the right word is, but towards the other like popular kind of way of going in the last 10 years?
You know, I think 5 years ago, I had a chip on my shoulder before I had done much, before I had made much money. I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder because these service businesses, they're hard, right? Self-storage, I make it sound sexy on Twitter, but it's hard. It's a hard business. You got to get a bunch of tenants on board. They're unsophisticated people. Many of them don't have email addresses. You're operating in little small towns. You got to try to find deals, and everybody loves self-storage right now. It's really brutal. The truth is, I mean, I'm a little bit wiser than I was 5 years ago, a little less arrogant, and I'm not too proud to say that there are thousands of ways to make money. That's the beautiful thing about entrepreneurship. What Andrew's doing is phenomenal. What guys who raise VC money do is phenomenal. There's more great companies right now than there's ever been.
My whole thing is very similar to you, actually, which is there's thousands of ways to do something. Most of the time, the black and white takes are not necessarily completely accurate.
You got to use some nuance and drive a wedge. I mean, that's what I'm good at. I can write good copyright. I can tell a good story. And that took a ton of practice. But I realized that to grow my business, to accomplish my goals, I love teaching, I love meeting new people like yourself. To accomplish my goals, I needed to find a way to make the unsexy sexy. And the only way that I can do that was kind of double down on that wedge, that chasm between, you know, mainstream, you know, entrepreneurship and what I do. So that's what I do.
Let's just give anyone who's listening here a little sense of scale. So you've talked about the portfolio and how long you've been doing it. So are there some numbers you could share there in terms of total portfolio size?
Yeah, I got it pulled up. Our first self-storage facility we built for $2.9 million back in 2017. We finished the build in 2017. That one has appreciated quite a bit. And in 2019, we did a cash out refinance of about $2 million for my partner and I to go build and buy more storage. Bought a couple more small ones because we weren't, you know, we were still proving our model. We needed more data. We bought, over the next year and a half, we bought 7 more self-storage facilities, just added an 8th last week. And now we are really scaling. So that took us to, let's see, our cost basis in those originals, about $10 million, worth about $15 million, 2,000 units or so, and 223,000 square feet of self-storage is what we own right now. But we have 12 properties under contract to close in the next 3 months, another 260,000 square feet, and another $20 million. So we're very soon going to have a cost basis of $30 million and a portfolio that, you know, generating $4 million a year in revenue. So we're excited.
Incredible, man. Just for people who are new to this space, including myself, you just mentioned a phrase there, which is a $2 million cash out refi. This is something we're going to go into in the section around how people in real estate don't pay necessarily as much tax if they know what they're doing, or legally, but using depreciation and other tools like that. So could you just explain what that means? So my understanding was in 2019, you took out $2 million from the business that basically went in your checking account tax-free.
Yeah, so we built a facility for $2.9 million with some partners. We filled it up then. We got a lot of customers, got some our net operating income. We raised that money, so it was more profitable. And we got it valued at the end of 2019 for $5.2 million. So you went from, let's say, a $3 million valuation to a $5 million valuation. Well, the bank doesn't care how much money you have in it, what you paid for it. The bank cares in commercial real estate, for the most part, how much money it makes. So if it makes more money, it can support more debt. When it's worth more money, it supports more debt. So we went and got a 70% LTV loan on that $5.2 million. And, you know, that loan was bigger than the cash we had put in and the cash that we had borrowed previously. So we paid off our previous loan and we had some leftover reserves. And since that's recourse debt, meaning I personally guarantee that debt, it's a tax-free event, and I can pull that out and use it to grow and buy and build more self-storage.
That's crazy. So, I mean, that's definitely something we're going to go into, because I think a lot of people listening to this may have read recent news over the last year around even the now former president, and what people talked about his real estate and how much tax he had paid from that. That's a whole different, we don't need to go in all the details of that, but
it's real estate. Yeah. People don't understand that, you know, people like that pay a ton of property taxes. They pay a ton of employment taxes, but they don't pay income taxes because the government incentivizes buying, holding, and investing in real estate. And one of those ways is depreciation. When you buy a $1 million self-storage facility, you can write off a lot of that purchase every year against your income, even though the bank paid for most of it, right? The bank paid for 75% of it, but me as an owner, I can write off a lot of that. There's something called bonus depreciation, where you can actually depreciate more in the early years of owning that asset. And that is what really makes the big difference when it comes to paying taxes.
So if you're listening to this, you're interested, make sure you're hanging around for that part. We're going to go into a lot more detail around that playbook. You talked about growing up in a 200-person small town in Indiana. A lot of people listening to this aren't even from the States. So, like, I'd love for you to be able to share, like, what was that like environment like?
My dad bought a 200-acre peach orchard. My dad's an adventurer like me. He's a wild man. He is not afraid to take risks. He's not afraid to make things happen. So he got a job out in a small town called Tulsa, Indiana, and he bought a dilapidated peach orchard, 200 acres surrounded by Hoosier National Forest. So I went from living in the city on an eighth of an acre when I was in, I was probably, you know, second grade to third grade. I was on a 200 acre farm, living in a farmhouse, going to a school where I had to drive 10 miles to get to the school. And, you know, there's 83 people in my class at that point. So, it was small town, right? There's no diversity, very little economic diversity. Everybody was middle class. Everybody was German descent. And, you know, it was a great childhood, though. My parents did well and treated me well, and I made friends and learned about life.
You talked about having a chip on your shoulder. So I'm curious, like, where do you feel like that might have come from?
Yeah, my dad pumped me up. I mean, you have a lot of influence from above as you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And my father made me feel confident. He made me feel like I could do anything. And so I didn't, you know, that anxiety, that uncertainty, that fear of failure, that uncomfortableness that comes with trying to do anything worth doing, I was just able to suppress that and get out there and put myself out there and take risks. So, you know, the fear of rejection wasn't as strong for me as most people. So when I went to Cornell, I met a lot of wealthy kids from wealthy families who were a lot smarter than me and faster than me, and by all means, you know, more set up for success than I was. And I had something to prove, I guess. Still do.
I'm curious, because that sounds like when you kind of were like early 20s and you went into this storage business, and it looked like you and a few friends set up this really, you know, manual labor business back in the day, when all your friends are probably like, what the hell are they doing?
They're going to get investment banking jobs in New York City, making, you know, 100 grand a year out of college. And me and my business partner, Dan, bought a $1,500 van on Craigslist and started hauling boxes around while they were all partying. We got laughed at, right? I mean, what are you guys doing? You're starting a moving company right now with your Ivy League degrees? And, you know, we just did the best we could. We made the best decision we could with the information we had every day and worked our butts off and weren't afraid to take a little risk and scale up a little bit. And we just learned a ton, and it set me up for success.
If you've been following the business world for the last 10, 15 years, it's really just the only thing that seems to be growing in the press are these high growth tech startups, which, again, I'm a huge fan of if they're doing it in the right way. And now I'd say in the last 5 years, there has been a lot more examples, at least, being shared of internet businesses that are not VC backed, more like self-funded, bootstrap style, indie hackers, that sort of stuff, which is great. But I would put yours in a whole different third bucket.
I think about the wealthy people that I know, and I didn't come from a network that was piped into the real entrepreneurs of California and the Ivy League. The wealthy people that I know, they don't even consider themselves entrepreneurs. They're opportunists that did something to add value. They did something small at first, then they did something a little larger, then they did something a little bigger, and they just kept growing. Business is about momentum, right? If you start really small, making, you know, $1,000, which is what Danny and I did in one weekend, we went out and made $1,000 and we're like, oh, okay, let's try to do that a little bit more. We don't know what we're doing. Let's just figure it out. You can do big things. And when you look up from your computer screen, and when you look up at your neighborhood and the world around you and the wealthy people in our world, many, many, many of them started doing completely not new things, not sexy things. They just found a way to operate a little bit better and choose competition that wasn't that strong, and they made money in their towns.
Let's start diving into the real estate section here. So you've in your amazing upcoming course and book that you've been sharing with me before, I don't think it's completely finished yet, so I don't know how much we can talk about it. But one of the chapters, or right in the beginning, you start off talking about how to get wealthy in real estate and the kind of formula and the two different parts, which is the fundamental side and the business aspect side, and combining them together is how you get wealthy in real estate. But before we even go into that, I've also heard you talk about you don't think real estate is the best place to create wealth. It's one of the best places to grow and steadily grow over time. But in the beginning, you don't actually recommend people do that, because you think you need to spend more time on doubling, tripling, quadrupling your income in early years. So could you talk a little bit about that? Like, you have made your money in this space, but you're saying other people potentially shouldn't.
Well, I didn't make my money in real estate. I made my money with my small business. And when I was ready to get into real estate, I had $700,000 in the bank. So I was ready to go kind of big. And my snowball started rolling down the hill with a lot of snow already on it, right? There's a lot of, you look on Twitter, you look on, you know, Clubhouse and all over the internet, there's a lot of folks who say, like, let's get rich in real estate. If you have nothing right now, I'm going to show you how to make money in real estate. And yes, you can make money wholesaling. Yes, you can make money house hacking. That is a great, you know, it's a great opportunity to go buy a house and rent it out. But it's not the best way to make money, in my opinion. The best way to make money is entrepreneurship, small business, doing something that is not necessarily scalable, but you can trade your time for money at first, do it in a low risk way, and before you know it, you're making $200,000-$400,000 a year. That's the best way to build up that original snowball. And another thing that people don't understand about real estate, that's never talked about real estate, is the operational side of it, the business side of it, getting the customers, doing the marketing, doing the delegating, the hiring, the firing. You're building a team around you. You look at me as a real estate investor, my job is no different than it was when I was a business owner. It's exactly the same, except now I'm buying hard assets that are worth a lot more money, making a lot more money, and a lot more tax efficient, right? And I can use leverage more and other people's money more. But down, you know, if you boil it all down, I am a small business operator, and that gives me an insane advantage when it comes to real estate, because I can come in, look at a property and say, okay, this operator, you know, these are things that I can do to add value to this property. Whereas most people look at real estate and say, okay, I'm going to buy this property and take what this real estate has to offer. So in my course, I talk a lot about operational advantages, running it like a business, and you know, getting some alpha. You know, everybody wants the beta. The market trends of real estate are great, but if you can get better returns than anybody else and a property is worth more to you than it is to anybody else, you're in a spectacular position to make a lot of money really fast.
What's alpha for people who don't know what that means?
Yeah, so beta is market trends, right? Say the market goes up 10% a year, that's beta. Real estate asset class does 10% a year, that's market average. Alpha is that additional return, that additional yield that not everybody can get, that we're all fighting for in this business, right? We're all trying to make our assets do a little bit better. That's the alpha.
So you talked about growing from, you know, a few hundred to 400, and then
you want to go through our first deal?
Yeah, let's talk about, like, if you remember how you got to that 700K.
Service business, the first year we did, you know, 10 grand of revenue, and then we threw the cash on our dorm bedroom, right? We didn't even have a business. We didn't have a website. We didn't have a domain. We had nothing. We went out and made the money first. Like, we went out and said, okay, let's make some money. And boom, we made $10,000. And that was our proof of concept. And then we went for it. The next year, that's when we reinvested. We got a legitimate warehouse. We got the insurance. We got the website. We started spending money. We bought a couple vans, and we were not profitable. We did around 50 grand of revenue, not that profitable. The year after that is when things started to rock and roll. We went to a few new colleges, 300,000 in revenue. Me and my business partner had enough money to pay ourselves 30, 40 grand a year to live. Year after that is when it really kind of took off. That was when we did almost a million in revenue, 200,000 or so in profit. Almost all of it got reinvested again. But by the time we were at year four, year five, we were doing 1.5, 2 million a year and producing $500,000 a year in cash flow. You do that for 2 or 3 years and you live as an extremely frugal person, as I am, the money starts to pile up in the checking account. And at that point, we decided to build a self-storage facility, which is not the way that I would recommend anybody get involved in real estate now. But we took a big risk and it paid off.
Just to clarify, what was the actual, for people who don't know, that original business though, because it was service-based, you said?
Yeah, it was a pickup and delivery student storage company. We actually sold that business a month ago today. On December 21st, we sold the business. Because now we're going to focus on self-storage. We needed that capital to go build and buy more self-storage. And but yeah, it was a pickup and delivery student storage company where we drove around in cargo vans and box trucks and picked up people's stuff. And we learned logistics because I was sitting in Boston, Massachusetts, overseeing 7 trucks driving around Boston with 14 part-time college students working for us. And at the same time, that was going on in many other towns because we went from 3 or 4 full-time employees to 300 part-time employees all over the country doing pickup and delivery storage, where we had to have trained employees with the right equipment in a rented truck in Des Moines, Iowa, at the right place at the right time. And it was tough. And we learned a lot about systems and delegation and getting things right. And I wouldn't trade, you know, the years. What we learned was the real valuable part of that business.
So you built up this nest egg because I think a lot of people who follow your work nowadays just see you as like a real estate investor. But the way you describe it there, as you said, is really you're a small business owner doing services, making cash, reinvesting it, and in hiring people. Like, you're not, your leverage wasn't the fact that you could ship more code and there are another million people signed up to your product. It was you had to hire a bunch of students to go and do this work for you. Let's say you get to this 700K amount. I'm just curious to ask, were you investing any of this into other things, or were you just literally letting this grow in your bank account?
We didn't know what we were doing. We were so busy growing our small business that this cash sat in our checking account until we spent it.
So you were essentially losing money in real terms because of inflation, and you probably didn't, you know that you could maybe invest it elsewhere. Or maybe, I'm curious, was that because you didn't necessarily know the alternatives, or you didn't have the time to think about it, or were you just saying, I just want this cash because then I want to reinvest it into another business at some point?
Yeah, we knew we wanted to invest it, and we knew that real estate was our end goal, but we didn't know much about real estate. I'm really writing this course for myself 10 years ago, a guy sitting on some cash who's cash rich and asset poor and wants to change that.
In terms of having that initial nest egg, you had 700K, which most people in the world never even get to that stage.
Well, I had half that. So I had 350K and I had a business partner with the other half. Yep.
Got it. Okay. For someone who's listening to this, who's saying, okay, you're saying I don't need to, I shouldn't invest in real estate as a way to build wealth, but at some point, maybe it's the right time to do it. So do you have in mind a rough kind of like initial nest egg size that you feel like people should be at least aiming for minimum?
If you have no money, no experience, and no wealthy friends, then you need to do it my way, because that's what I had. If you have a parent who's worth a couple million bucks who wants to invest in real estate and wants to support you, or a neighbor or a professor or anybody in your network that wants to do this stuff with you, you can skip a lot of steps. You don't even have to do the service business part of it, because you can build real estate with other people's money. You can structure the debt so that those people come on as limited partners. You are the sponsor of the deal. You get a percentage of the gains. But so there's no right answer. It's different for everybody. How much cash do you need to buy your asset? We were trying to build a $2 million building with a lot of risk. We went really big. You can buy a lot of self-storage facilities out there for 500 grand. And at that point, you know, if you have 50 grand in the bank and you can round up some friends who have 50 grand each, you can do the deal, right? It all kind of depends on, and looking back, we should have done a self-storage facility back in 2014, a much smaller one. You know, we should have done that instead of build it into a high risk development. We should have bought an operational facility, taken it over, and started adding value right then.
And I definitely agree. It's difficult to give like one number. It also depends where you live, like cost of living.
I'd say a good rule of thumb is like you need double the cash that you need to put down on the purchase. 25% of an asset cost is going to be cash. So if you're buying a $1 million building, you need 250 grand. I'm a risk averse person at this point because I have something to lose. I don't want to lose money. I don't want to lose everything. So I like to have double the cash as what I need to build. So I'm going to have 500 grand in the bank to do that $1 million deal with 250,000. But all that changes if you can raise outside money. If you can raise outside money from friends and family, you can do it with a lot less. But you got to have some reserves. Like real estate gets risky. If inflation kicks off and debt goes, you know, gets more expensive and your property is less valuable, there's a lot of risk factors in real estate. I think there's far more bankruptcies than there are billionaires in the real estate business.
Yeah. So, and I definitely agree with, you know, this is definitely not investment advice. Like people need to do their own research, whatever. But I like that rule of thumb because that gives some people a sense of, okay, I've got 200 grand in the bank. I therefore should maybe potentially think about allocating half of that. I still need the other half for other stuff. For someone who wants to say, start a keep their job or do their own business, but do some real estate investing on the side, what would you recommend for someone like that?
So there's a whole world out there of investing with operators as well that people don't even take into account. There's 20 people that I know on Twitter that do deals. They run the deal, they buy the deal, they build the models, they operate the real estate, and they raise money from outside investors that are called LPs. I guess it's a wild alternative investment in today's world because very few people do it, but it is a very good way to get real estate exposure without taking the risk of, hey, I don't know how to operate this. I don't know what I'm doing. You can actually sometimes make a lot more money by investing with others. That's one option. And I mean, as far as what asset class you might want to go at, there are a ton that I like. You saw it in a list of niche real estate. Like there's short-term rentals, there's executive rentals, there's tiny homes, there's multifamily, mobile homes, Section 8 housing, RV parks, cemeteries, mobile home, mobile office, medical office, hospitals, professional office, dental office, you know, small-scale retail, last-mile logistics, cell towers, hostels, gas stations, amusement parks, factories, marinas, entertainment, golf course. You know, there's millions
there's
of these
lot.
Things of different types of real estate that you can find. But yeah, you know, self-storage is one that I really like because you're hedged. You have a lot of different tenants. If one tenant moves out and you own a retail store in Kmart on the corner who pays 3/4 of your rent, they go bankrupt, you know, your asset instantly is worth a third of what it was worth. That's a problem. But on the other hand, if you, you know, have 200 tenants like self-storage or an RV park or a mobile home park, you're hedged, right? You have less risk. And I like, you know, asset light, some that are operation heavy, like there's some sweatiness to them that you can kind of carve out a piece of the pie.
Yeah, I think what I'm getting from what you're saying is, you know, someone could go and buy residential real estate, rent it out to tenants, and that, you know, has been happening for forever. But there are less variables there, and there's more people competing.
I have a framework here, a fragmented market with many different operators. Like, I want that. I don't want any one company that dominates a market. Like, I want it to be a fragmented, you know, business. Number two, I want it to be like low sophistication. They run their businesses like it's 1985. And number three, an operationally or logistical challenge. Those three things. That makes it so that not very many people compete. Like, the bigger pockets crowd, I'm sitting in Athens, Georgia. There's probably 1,000 people in Athens right now on LoopNet or on Zillow looking for a rental property to buy because they got 20 grand in their pocket. They've listened to bigger pockets. They know how it works. It's easy. On the other hand, there's a lot of that real estate, right? There's a lot of them out there. But if you can find a niche, if you can find something that only you can do, if you can operate a marina, if you can buy a cemetery, if you can operate a golf course, if you can operate a self-storage facility, you're going to compete. I compete sometimes with one or two other buyers on a property.
Let's talk a little bit about your playbook in doing that, because my understanding is you buy these existing facilities, you're looking for the fragmented market. One of the things I heard you talk about was occupancy rates in self-storage, and you're looking to ideally have 85% occupancy rate. Is that correct?
You've done a lot of research. This is a great interview. You're hitting my sweet spots. Yeah, so I look for a market with high occupancy and low and sub-market rents, meaning that almost every unit is rented and the people aren't charging enough money. That happens in small business, that happens in real estate, it happens all over the place, is that people would rather be 100% full than maximize revenue. So what I do is I find properties that are sub-institutional, meaning big money is not looking for these properties because they're small. Like Andrew, maybe he buys bigger businesses now, but at the beginning he bought a couple really small companies that private equity wasn't looking at. Mm. Big money's not looking at, because money is pouring into self-storage right now. If you listed a $20 million portfolio for sale right now anywhere in the country, that would sell at a 5 cap and you'd have 50 buyers bidding on it before it even went to the market. 5 cap means a 5% return on overall spend. So if you spend $1 million, you're only making $50,000 in net operating income.
So just to be specific with that, so if you were listing, do you say $20 million portfolio?
I'll tell you a little bit more. So there's scale here. On these smaller deals, you know, we can buy at an 8 cap, meaning we get an 8% return on our buy. If we're going to buy a $1 million facility, not very many people are in the market for a $1 million facility. That's the sweet spot because it's too large for a lot of smaller investors and it's too small for the big money players. So you can buy it at an 8 cap, meaning you can make $80,000 in net operating income on that 1 million, 8%, $80,000. Now, when you combine these things and when you roll them up, and that's what I'm doing, this is my strategy, when you have more of them, when you add more facilities, and all of a sudden now Nick has went around and bought 20 $1 million facilities and it's worth $20 million, if I listed this for sale, it's more valuable now because it's less risky, it's bigger, there's more money that could potentially buy it, and now maybe it's worth a 7 cap or a 6 cap or, God forbid, a 5 cap. I don't know, but it gets more valuable as you roll up these small real estate asset classes. And this is what people do to make real money. They do the brain damage to go and find and buy these smaller deals. They roll them together into a package and all of a sudden they're worth a heck of a lot more.
Yeah, that's great. And to draw the parallel again, in the kind of micro private equity world, which is what we talked about before, you know, a lot of people are doing a similar thing where traditional private equity buying things on a 5x, 10x profit or revenue multiplier. And these guys are coming in buying something for a couple hundred grand at a 3x multiple. And then they're rolling it up, they're growing it, and then they're going to sell for more because it's more valuable.
My portfolio is a great example. We've went around and we've done a lot of brain damage to buy really good deals. Our basis is about a 10 cap, meaning we have $30 million deployed and we're going to make about $3 million in net operating income. But when you have $30 million portfolio, it's not worth a 10 cap, it's worth a 6 cap. So our portfolio right now is worth $48 million. So we spent 30 to buy it and we're operating it well, we're increasing net operating income, and now it's worth $48 million.
So we're gonna go into that, the occupancy rate. I love this example because what I understood from what you said was you're looking at these old school places, fax machine, they've got a 98% occupancy rate, which generally signals, so an amateur would say, oh, that's great, they've got everyone is filled up. But what you're seeing is, well, they're charging too little.
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. We bought a property in a middle Pennsylvania town about 4 weeks ago, and they were charging $52 for a 10 by 10 unit, and they were 100% full. They didn't have a single vacant unit. We have to get a couple tenants out who aren't paying, but for the most part, they're full, and they have been for 10 years. We buy this thing, and it's producing you know, let's say we buy it at an in-place 7 cap, meaning it's producing $70,000 a year, but we're going to raise, the rents are way low. They're way low. We're going to raise them $20 a month on every unit because that's what the market rent is. We need to raise the rents up so that we can have some vacancy and have an available unit and serve the people who need a unit. The people in town are driving 20, 30 minutes away because they can't find a unit. So we raise the rents up and all of a sudden our net operating income becomes $100,000 or $110,000. And it's a lot more valuable at that point. So it's a perfect combination of operations when you can find these mom and pop operators, the unsophisticated operators who, you know, they're friends with the tenants, their neighbors rent from them, the kids who went to their son's high school rents from them, and they never raise rents. They haven't raised them in 7 years in this case.
Yeah, so you're going to raise rents. That's already going to increase your kind of your profits essentially. And then on the flip side, you're finding stuff that's generally under, you know, it's well priced in terms of what you're paying for it as well. So on both sides, you're increasing the margin, and that is something from day one you can see before you even invest.
And from the operational standpoint, we don't need a full-time manager on site because we wrap this thing in technology. So we're cutting expenses as well.
Yeah, let's go into that a little bit.
Yeah, so we're hitting this from all sides. We're buying a good deal because it's in the middle of nowhere and nobody wants to buy it. We're raising revenue because it's sub-market rent, and we're cutting expenses because we can use technology to operate the business very efficiently, and they can pull up to a storage facility, they can rent a unit on their phone, they can rent a unit on the night, they can call somebody and they'll ring our customer service rep who's staying at home outside of Chicago. They don't, you know, they're getting great service, they can rent units, they can sign their lease online, they can move right in. And it's one of the many real estate asset classes that's just ripe for people to do what I do, which is, you know, roll these things up and buy them.
We touched on it earlier, but if I was a 18, 21 year old coming fresh out of school and I didn't know anything about real estate, and let's just say I pretty much don't, so let's pretend it's me. how would you explain the tax benefits of real estate? And we touched on it earlier with depreciation, but maybe we can go into a little bit more detail.
Yeah, let's do an example. Let's say I buy a $1 million self-storage facility. There's this part of the tax code called bonus depreciation, meaning not every bit of that self-storage facility is depreciated over a 29-year time. Usually the $1 million is divided by 29 because it's one, you know, that percentage every year for 29 years, a very small deduction every year. But there's a new part of the tax code where you can write off more of that expense early on in the life cycle because the roof is not, you know, a 30-year time cycle. The doors, the landscaping, that can all be depreciated quicker. So you group all the stuff that's under 15 years, and bonus depreciation, a part of the tax code, allows you to write it off all in the very first year. And sometimes that's, you know, 15, 20, 25% of the overall purchase price of the asset. So if we buy a $1 million self-storage facility, we can write off in the very first, well, we only need to put $250,000 down, right? The bank is going to finance 75%. So $750,000 of that's coming from the bank, $250,000 of that is coming from me. And now the very first year I can write off with bonus depreciation, $250,000 of that purchase against my income. But my income is nowhere near $250,000 on this self-storage facility the very first year. I'm only going to make 30 or 40 grand on it. So you have a big excess there. You have a big tax write-off above and beyond what your income is on that property the year that you put it in service. So that $250,000 tax write-off, you know, it writes off about $50,000 of income from this self-storage facility. But the other $200,000 I can take and write off against the rest of my portfolio, all of my other income, and virtually, if I buy a couple facilities every single year with bonus depreciation, you can pay very little taxes. And that is exactly how you know who paid $750 in taxes.
That's crazy. So depreciation, bonus depreciation. Do you know if you can apply this in other asset classes, or is it really real estate specific?
It's just real estate. It's just real estate. Mm. Yep. There are some other things too. I mean, you can have a, you know, you can write off your interest, even though the bank bought $750,000 of your self-storage facility and you're paying that bank interest on that purchase, you can write off that interest as an expense, which is another controversial write-off. If you sell that self-storage facility later for $2 million and you've realized the $1 million gain, if you roll that purchase price into another self-storage facility, it's called a 1031 exchange or a like-kind exchange, you can roll that capital gain into another self-storage facility, and you don't have to pay the capital gains. It pushes it off into the future. Imagine if you could sell a stock at a gain, and if you bought another stock, you don't have to pay your capital gains on that stock, right? That doesn't happen, but in real estate, it does. So there's a lot of ways to push and defer, and you're not getting a tax. The tax isn't going away. It's deferred. It's pushed off into the future. So real estate professionals, all we do is push our tax liability further and further and further in the future.
To play that out though, so does that mean one day you have to pay a bunch of tax, or does that mean it just keeps going until you die?
Yeah, it decreases what's called your basis. So your basis in the building, how much does Nick have in this building that he hasn't deducted so far? Every time you write off these expenses, it reduces your basis. So the $1 million self-storage facility, I write off $250,000 the very first year. My basis goes down to $750,000. If I sell it for $2 million, now I'm paying taxes on $1.25 million, not just the $1 million in gain. So it does catch up to you later in something called recapture, where that tax comes due when you finally sell and realize your gains.
Is there a plan for how that works later down the line for you? Because I guess there's still a benefit overall, but just so I understand that last part there.
Yeah, tax a dollar paid right now in taxes is a lot more expensive than a dollar paid 10 years from now in taxes, because I am rolling my snowball down a hill and I'm rolling my assets into new storage. And every dollar that I get to keep is a dollar that I can invest and earn 25% return on. So me pushing my taxes off 10 years is absolutely huge for my net worth and my portfolio, because the $1 that Uncle Sam would have got now is earning me 25% every single year for 10 years. And then I need to pay that $1.
Oh, so it's still the same amount later.
Yeah, the tax is deferred. The tax amount is the same, but you're saving it over time.
So this is something that a lot of us hear about in the news, and people see the headlines and they're like, oh, those people don't pay taxes. But thanks for sharing like exactly how that works, because that was a tangible example that made it click for me.
And we got to talk about property taxes too. I pay almost $500,000 a year now in property taxes.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So that's the other side which people don't always think about. So
real estate is encouraged. Like the government encourages people to buy and invest in real estate for one reason, because our country needs infrastructure. We need hospitals. We need buildings. We need houses. We need people to maintain them and put money in them and buy them and build them. But everybody who owns all the real estate in a certain town pays for the schools. They pay for the schools. They pay for the roads. They pay county taxes. So me at a self-storage facility in Ithaca, New York, I pay $75,000 a year in property taxes from that one property. So like that alone puts four kids through high school every year.
I mean, obviously paying tax isn't a bad thing. It's fine. Like that's part of being a citizen. But like, are there other things like that we don't always think about? Because right now it sounds like, oh, we can just defer all the tax and pay that later.
Yeah, it sounds like I'm a villain, right? It sounds like I'm a villain. And I honestly don't hate taxes at all. I don't enjoy writing the check, but I do. I feel like I'm serving my country when I can pay some taxes. But yeah, the intrinsic value that real estate investors add to communities to build more housing, to build more, you know, self-storage is kind of a crappy example because it's just a box that looks kind of dumpy on the corner of a busy road. But, you know, the government incentivizes what we do for a reason, so that there's more buildings and more houses and more, you know, structures that we can use as a society.
So just to summarize, because I think that was quite a meaty section there, we talked about depreciation, where in residential real estate over 27 and a half years.
You can do the same things in residential real estate. So yeah. There's something called a cost segregation study that you pay to have done on your real estate. I bought a house in upstate New York this year that I'm renting out on Airbnb and I'm staying in sometimes. That home purchase, I did bonus depreciation on. That home purchase saved me $46,000 this year in taxes. Many, many people should be doing an aggressive depreciation schedule and they're not. And if you need, I'm going to give my contact information at the end of this thing, but if you need a recommendation for a cost segregation study or you want more information on this, just reach out to me.
I love that. So, and just to clarify, so that's anyone who's got residential real estate. You can do depreciation there over 27 and a half years, 39 years I read for commercial.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
And each year you can write off 2 to 3.6% are the numbers. Then you've got bonus depreciation, which is a few examples you just gave. And then there's the 1031 exchanges. Those are like three things I didn't know anything about.
The craziest one is the conservation easement. The conservation easement is the craziest thing ever. And it's very shady, and there's a lot of people that are going to go to jail because of this. But basically, imagine we're in Juniper, Florida, where all the really wealthy people live, and there's a golf course that Michael Jordan, he actually did this. He turned a swamp into a golf course. He spent enough money to turn a swamp into a golf course in Juniper, Florida. So what happened was there's other investors that are buying now the swamp around Michael Jordan's golf course. And they are then getting the appraiser to come and say, okay, how much is Michael Jordan's golf course worth? This land is now worth the same, because really it's not. It's worthless, right? The appraisers are kind of shady. They're coming in, they're putting a high value on that property. And then what you can do in the tax code is make a conservation easement where, say, I own some land. Say I own some of that swamp. I'm going to give it a value, and I'm going to donate it to a conservation program, or I'm going to donate it to basically the government. I'm going to make it available for everybody. It was put in place to like make parks and pristine land available to the public, but it's being taken advantage of. And that the value of the property when you make that donation is used like you are making a donation to a charity, and it's a tax deduction. So let's say you buy the swamp for $10 million in Juniper, Florida, but the appraiser comes in and says, oh, Michael Jordan built this golf course over here. This is worth a lot more now. This is worth $200 million, this 90 acres you bought. Let's donate it all to the government and get a $200 million deduction. And they basically turn this into a syndicate, and they sell parts of it, and everybody gets a little bit of a tax deduction. It's a big old crooked scheme, and a lot of people got busted.
That's insane, man. So yeah, I think there was an episode on Malcolm Gladwell's podcast ages ago about golf courses specifically and how they kind of get away with some crazy stuff as well. So people should check that out. So look, we're going to look, you've got so many advanced versions of this. So we won't have time to go into every single one. But I've got a few here that you've mentioned that I don't know anything about any of these. So let me know if any of these stand out as something we should at least just touch on, and then people can go and look into it themselves. You also talked about real estate professional status as one other strategy. What is the benefit of that?
Yeah, if you're a real estate professional as a job, because there's two types of income. There's active income and there's passive income. You can't use real estate losses from that bonus depreciation to offset your W-2 active income unless you are a full-time real estate professional. So there's two types of income. They can't write each other off unless you're a real estate professional. So you can get that status by following part of the tax code, and then that income can, or that loss can wipe out other passive income.
Got it. And there's a few more that we're just doing quick time. Step up in basis, what does that mean?
So if I have a $50 million portfolio and my basis is down, I've depreciated it all the way down. So let's say I have $0 left in basis, and if I sell this $50 million portfolio, I pay taxes on $50 million because I've depreciated, I've taken all the tax losses over time. If I pass away and I die and I give my entire portfolio to my children, they get a step up in basis to the new value. And all that tax deferred income goes away, and you don't have to pay taxes on it. Your basis steps back up. It's a huge, huge benefit to passing real estate down through families and trusts.
That's huge. Again, I don't think a lot of people know this stuff. So there's also income capital gains, which I think is more straightforward.
If you hold an asset for over a year, it's taxed at capital gains rates instead of standard income rates.
Yeah.
And right. I'm not a CPA. I know this stuff very well, but please don't take this as tax advice.
Yeah, this big asterisk here that this is not financial advice as well, so we don't get sued. But yeah, people should at least take this, dive into it themselves, and then work with a CPA or someone who knows more about this to do this properly. Make sure you're doing it by the book. We're going to move into the second section of the show, which is called Behind the Mind, where we talk about kind of ideas and the philosophy of Sweaty Startup and kind of like how you see the world. One thing I will say is you had this incredible tweet storm, which we'll also link in the show notes. And if you're on YouTube, you'll see this on the screen right now. You gained 30,000 followers in 3 days from this tweet storm. From the numbers I could see, it looked like this was one of the main drivers.
5.8 million people saw that tweet.
That's crazy. And it was incredible. It sounded like you had gone to the mountains and you were like, you were just like taken in, you were just thinking, and you just were just writing whatever that was, that process was like. Maybe we'll go into that in a second. And each tweet was just like, here's something you've been told, and here's an alternative perspective on it, which I love, because as we said earlier, there's a lot of black and white takes. I'm curious just to place ourselves with you on that day when you were writing this out. Like, what was that process like for you, and kind of like what got you in this mode to be writing this in the first place?
Yeah, so my wife and I got a truck and two snowmobiles, and we drove up to a town called Turin, New York, in the Tug Hill Plateau, and our cell phone service cut off about 5 miles back on the road near Rome, New York. And we parked the truck, we got our backpacks on and our pillows, and we got on our snowmobiles, and we rode our snowmobiles about 10 miles into the wilderness, the Tug Hill Plateau, and stayed in a cabin with no plumbing and no electricity for two full days and only one night. We were away from our kids. But it was the first time both of us have been away from our two kids, a three-year-old and a one-year-old. And it was just awesome. I turned my phone off, and I have pretty severe phone addiction. I'm dealing with that, trying to find a way to deal with it. But got up there, got away, rode the snowmobiles around, sat around in a log cabin with friends, and, you know, drank bourbon and smoked cigars and hung out. And when we got back, we parked in the garage, and I walked in the house, and the kids were in bed already, and I was like, honey, I'm gonna go do a little bit of writing, and I went downstairs, and it wasn't planned, it wasn't drafted, it wasn't a bunch of thoughts that I had. I mean, there a lot of the concepts I'd done a lot of talking on, but I pulled up Twitter and started live tweeting, like just started tweeting, and 4 hours later, there's 112 tweets or whatever it was, and it got a little bit of traction.
Yeah, it definitely did. One of the things that you started off early on was talking about chasing your passion is a bad idea, best way to end in heartbreak. So I'm curious to go into that a little bit deeper. Like, why do you think that's obviously something people often hear, especially at college, like find what you're passionate about. And there's a lot of people listening to this who are in a job that they don't love, and they're looking for that kind of savior for outside world, which is going to be like something they're passionate about. So I'm curious, like, why you think that?
You got to do your passions for fun and not for money, because when you do your passions for money, it becomes work really quick. And if you're passionate about it, a lot of other people are often passionate about it. And we go back to that piece on, you know, I feel like I'm successful because I chose the path of least resistance and the competition that was weak. And if you're passionate about it, a lot of other people are probably passionate about it, and you have to be really good to succeed. And unfortunately, in this world, you know, 75% of people are not competent enough to succeed at entrepreneurship or small business. And when you're in a really highly competitive passion project, the odds are even lower. So we hear a lot of, you know, talk, and we hear a lot of the survivorship bias of people who have been really successful and chasing their passion, and you can work longer because you're passionate about it, and you can work harder because you're passionate about it. And I just think it's all bullshit.
Yeah. Well, I think it's definitely an interesting take, and I overall probably agree with you. But what I would say is, I think if you're starting a business in an area that you're genuinely interested in, it doesn't have to be the hot thing that everyone's trying to work on, AI, VR, whatever. But I will say, like, I've seen great examples of people who were just so interested in, like, I talked to Ryan Beagleman on the show, who started Summit Series, about like pickleball, which is like a sport I've never heard. And he just got into that as a hobby. And then he started, like, he's talking about using that as something he'll build out something in, because he knows so much about it that most people don't. So I think it's definitely a balance there of not just chasing stuff because it's like there's an opportunity money-wise, because you might not have the motivation to keep doing it when you don't find it interesting at all.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, I think it's a balance, right? I mean, I'm of the camp that, hey, I'm going to find a way to make money so that I can do what I'm passionate about. And right here, what I'm doing with you and what I do on Twitter and what I do on my podcast and with my course, that's the stuff that I'm passionate about. But unfortunately, in this world, if you have no money and no influence, it's really, 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 really hard to have the freedom to do what you're passionate about. Unfortunately, a lot of people are you know, still insecure about food and can't even put food on the table, let alone think about hobbies and what they want to do. And it's a sad deal. And yeah, you're right. There's a lot of ways to win. There's a lot of ways to win. I'm of the camp, hey, let's find the best opportunity. And you have to be passionate about building a business, because when you're an entrepreneur, that thing that you're passionate about, if you're a true entrepreneur and you're actually going to build something that can create money, you're going to be doing the same five things as every other entrepreneur in about 6 months. You're going to be hiring, firing, managing, and making hard decisions. That's it. You're not going to be doing the thing about the thing that you love. If you're a restaurant operator and you're a big restaurant, big time restaurant owner, you're not the chef. You're not cooking the food. You're not enjoying the food. A good chef is a good businessman. A good chef is good at logistics. A good chef is good at hiring and firing and communicating and delegating all the things that you need to do as a business owner. And if you are passionate about it, you're less likely to delegate. You're more likely to say, get out of my way. I'm going to play pickleball. I'm going to worry about the food. I'm going to do this in tunnel vision, right? You can see the blind spots creep in really heavily when you chase what you're passionate about because you love it and emotions are very strong.
I think there's a tangential point there, which was something you also wrote about, which is 95% of folks are better off just getting a job, not trying to start a business. I definitely agree with this. So could you elaborate a little bit on why you think that?
Yeah, I changed my mind on a lot of stuff. And I'm sure that when I listen to this, 2 or 3 years from now, I'm going to have changed my mind on a lot of the stuff that we're talking about right now. A year ago, I was stubborn enough to think that what my business partner and I did was easy. And, you know, it wasn't luck. We just did it and anybody could do it. And all you got to do is learn to do it. And that's not true. It was really hard. We got very lucky and not everybody could do it. What we did took a lot of lucky decisions and good decisions and good communication and good delegation. And we did a lot of things right. Entrepreneurship is, you know, you see these people on Twitter and I'm guilty of it that say like, hey, you need to have money to make money. You need to own a business. You got to have leverage. You know how to get rich without getting lucky. You see all these things in mainstream media about entrepreneurship. And unfortunately, there's a lot of bad things about entrepreneurship that people don't see. You know, I was in a very bad mental state a couple times in the storage business when my employees were driving box trucks down highways in Boston and they went on the wrong road and on, you know, Soldier Field Drive and they ripped the roof off of our brand new truck when we didn't have any money in the bank to pay for the fix. And same day, another guy put gasoline in a diesel fuel engine and blew a motor up on a truck that we rented and we got a $6,000 bill. And I was in those two trucks were out broken down full of people's stuff. And the customers were calling us and I had a mental breakdown on the side of the road. I was crying. I was in a shitty warehouse in Medford, Massachusetts, having a breakdown on a sidewalk. And I wanted to just call my mother and cry in her arms that day.
Dude, we've all been there, man, for sure.
There's a lot of anxiety and stress. Yeah. Like we make it seem easy. We act tough. Us entrepreneurs, we're on the internet saying, oh, you know, we're badasses. We know what we're doing. But in reality, there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of insecurity. There's a lot of, hey, am I really doing this right? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Can I really be so sure of myself? Am I a scam? I don't, you know, there's a lot of that people don't talk about. And, you know, so a lot of times it's great to go into a company, add a ton of value, find a good boss that's going to pay you well and kick ass that way.
Yeah, 100%, man. I think a lot of people listening to this could easily be, you know, a lot of people listening to this are entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial folks, but there's also people who have got jobs and they want to do something more entrepreneurial and their best option might be joining a startup or joining as the number two or number three in a tiny place and joining someone else who's got that other part to them, which loves the crazy parts. Like,
yeah, there were probably 300 under 30 year old millionaires when Affirm went public last week. There's probably 300 people under 30 years old who became millionaires overnight when that company went public. And then there's the side hustle, right? There's the fact that you don't have to be an entrepreneur to be an opportunist, to do what all of our parents did and hustle a little bit and flip a house or buy something or make a little money on the side. There's a lot of ways to be entrepreneurial at a company, and there's a lot of ways to be entrepreneurial in your free time, and there's a lot of ways to be entrepreneurial working for a startup. You're right.
I love the way you call it an opportunist, because that's a great way of describing, because sometimes that is the kind of feeling you're going after. It's not necessarily you want to create a big company. It's just like, I want to do something outside of my comfort zone. I want to get that rush of the same rush you might get in a sale or like a win.
Why do people love sports in America? People love sports in America because of the uncertainty. You can see a team in football that lets the other team score with less than a minute left and comes back and wins the game. That it's crazy what happens in sports, and Americans need that uncertainty. And as an entrepreneur, what I love about being an entrepreneur is that the decisions I make now, we're taking a dive into uncertainty with every single one of them. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how it's going to result. It's all uncertain, and I'm just making the best decisions that I can, and then fielding the results, and then trying to make a better decision, fielding the results. It's a life of uncertainty. Some people like it, some people don't. I love it.
I heard you talk about giving up is often the best choice there is. And this is, I definitely agree, because I think a lot of times people can drag something out and they're just trying to make something of something that just doesn't have the legs to succeed. And it's maybe not because of them. They might be really talented, but the opportunity, the market isn't right. So I guess the follow-up question to that point is, are there ways you think about something where you've realized, okay, this is the time to move on from this, versus actually this is the relentless part, I need to just keep going, going hard and making it work? Because that's the fine balance of entrepreneurship, right? Is that there's plenty of times where you need to actually keep going, but you need the self-awareness to say, oh, this market is not the right one. So has that happened to you, and how did you think about it?
It has. We made it, you know, there was a 4-year trudge where we were not making good money yet. We were confident that we were adding value, and we stuck with it. Most people would have given up. We had an early business partner that gave up. We had a second business partner that gave up and walked away from Storage Squad. You know, I think it comes down to separating your time from money. Like, understanding that those are the two main assets. Time is one asset, and money is the other asset. If you have the money, like I had the money mindset, like, hey, money is the most precious resource. I need to protect it. I need to invest it. I need to make it. I need to cherish it. We made the shift of like, okay, time is much, much more valuable than money. Money is abundant. We could lose our self-storage facility portfolio and we'd be just fine. We can make the money back. We can build another business. We can do whatever. As soon as you realize that every second that ticks by is gone, and you know, that is what is really important. I think when you start to conceptualize it that way, you're much more likely to make a good decision around sticking it out or giving up, or, you know, how to think about that giant question of should I give up and move on from this.
Completely, man. The next one I had on here was, Miami isn't the next tech hub. So for context, the mayor of Miami is supposed to be coming on the show at some point, so I'll get his point of view on why he's trying to make it the next tech hub. And for context, if people aren't in the States or seen this, there's a lot of people moving from, well, I say a lot of people, more so on Twitter than necessarily in real life. There's been quite a lot of notable people moving from the Bay Area to Miami. Miami and Austin have been two of the big hubs where a lot of people are moving, which I think is a great thing. If people are moving around, we need people all over the world, not just in the US and one or two cities. But your take was that it's not the next big tech hub. People are overinflating this. So curious on your take on that.
I just, you know, stir the pot a little bit. I would love to see it grow. I think it is growing fast. Three friends of mine moved there, right? I love what the mayor's doing. I love the weather. I there's some things I don't like about it, you know, the hurricanes and things like that, and the heat. But yeah, I moved from Boston to a small town in Athens, Georgia in 2018. It's the best decision I ever made, but it was one of the most uncomfortable decisions I ever made. I realized that, hey, look, I have a lot more control over my tribe and over my surroundings than I think. So I'm going to leave this town and take a leap and go make new friends and build a new life. And it was the best decision I ever made. And I really encourage people to do that. People rarely do it. And I think that they'd be a lot better off if they did it sometimes.
Similarly, what you just mentioned there about people, I love this one, that nobody cares about you apart from a handful of people. And that one was just kind of hit me, because I definitely feel like in the last year, many of us have kind of realized that more so than ever. And that's not to say you don't have acquaintances or people you get on with at work or whatever, and they don't care about you. But ultimately, we all really care about a handful of people. We can probably count them on one or two hands. And being in a place where you have access to them, like something for me that I've really struggled with in the last year is, I'm in New York. I haven't been home to London to see my family since what's happened. Unfortunately, my grandmother passed away. I couldn't go to the funeral. There were like all these things, and you realize, okay, I'm far away. Normally, in a normal time, it's not a problem. I can just go over in 6-7 hours. But a time like this, you really appreciate that. So
I think there's two parts of it. I think one part of it is to not give a shit about what the masses think about you. It's really hard as a you know, supposed influencer on Twitter to not worry about what everybody's thinking and dissecting my tweets and worrying about this and worrying about, you know, that. people don't give a shit about me on the internet. I'm a very, very small part of their day. Now, yeah, this is all encompassing for me, but you know, getting past the fact that people don't care about you is really kind of freeing. It allows you to put out content that you don't think might be perfect. It allows you to just ship your thoughts and to put yourself out there, put your neck out there, get better and learn in public. A lot of advantages come to it. But on the other side of that, knowing that there's only five people, and some people, I think the people who don't build deep relationships and really get to know people and ask the questions about what they're afraid of and what they want to accomplish and find people who are close to you and know what you're afraid of and what you want to accomplish, they don't know anybody and nobody knows them. And it's sad. It's a sad deal because one of the most rewarding things about life is to figure out what drives people and what they're afraid of and what their weaknesses are and how they can get better and how you can help them get better. And unless you ask the tough questions and have those uncomfortable conversations with people, you don't build those deep relationships. And I really encourage people when next time you're on the date night with a friend of yours that you really like getting along with, maybe instead of just talking about football the whole time, maybe you ask them, you know, what they're afraid of and what they're worried about and what they're working on and get to know them a little bit, because then you just build deep, intimate relationships with people that are so much more rewarding.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like would add to that and say with my parents specifically, if you're still lucky to have your parents around, whether you live in 5 minutes from them or not, like I speak to my parents almost every day. Like I try to call them. We jump on a video call. They've got the portal set up in their room, so it feels like we're there, which is incredible. I almost feel like we speak, and they're probably listening to this, that we might speak more now than even when I like lived in the house, because when you live in the house, you take it for granted. You might have dinner with them, but you're busy with your own life. You're going to sleep. You're rushing around. Whereas now a little bit of distance, you appreciate a little bit more almost. But one thing I realized recently, and it's something I've been trying to shake up with myself with conversations, there's a lot of people who talk about like asking below the surface questions, and I think that's great, and moving beyond kind of small talk. But sometimes it's kind of like awkward, forced questions that are like way out there, and they're not really, you haven't warmed them up, you know, to have that deep connection.
I think the way to do it is to be vulnerable yourself. That's the way to do it.
Completely. But one thing I'll share with what I did with my parents recently, which was really fun. I was on, you know, Zoom or Facebook portal in this case, and I just started asking them about their childhood, where they grew up. So they're from Pakistan originally. And I literally opened up Google Maps, and we like zoomed into like all these different places, like my dad's village, and then like where he went to school.
Oh, and they started telling stories.
Exactly. And I didn't even plan this. And I was like, wow.
Did you record it? Hopefully you were recording it.
Do you know what? That one we didn't record because it was on Facebook portal. But I've been thinking about, I don't know if you saw recently on Twitter that my dad's messages to me, I've been sharing them from.
Yeah, Chris Powers. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and basically, my dad sends these amazing notes, and my mom as well nowadays. After this conversation, after watching it, they tell me like what they liked, the concepts they liked and ideas they remember, and they just share that with me. And I shared that on Twitter recently, and it went semi-viral at my scale anyway. It was about Andrew Wilkinson's episode, and because it was this pure, you know, gesture of love to a son, of like, good job, I'm proud of you, another one said something along the lines of, oh, it was all about sleep, that episode. And he was like, yeah, this is great. I'm cutting my caffeine after lunch. By the way, you look tired. You need to get some rest. Fatherly advice. So it was stuff like that. And I asked my dad if I could share it. And I did. And people were like, this is the most incredible thing. But I bring that up to say the conversations we had that day were so like deep, because they're like, my dad's like, oh, I used to take a bike from there and go 45 minutes to this other village, and then when I was 16 I moved to this other place. And then it just visualizes, you know, that conversation. So if you listen to this, you want to connect with your parents maybe in person, like that Google Maps thing was really cool, because you can even do the satellite view and they can share like some stories they don't usually.
That is awesome. I'm gonna go, when I see my grandfather next, I'm gonna pull up Google Maps on an iPad or computer, and I'm gonna zoom in on his house, and I'm gonna say, where'd you live before that? And let's go look at that. Yeah, that is awesome, man. That is awesome.
Yeah, man. And if you end up recording it and you ever want to share it, it might just be a personal thing. I'd say, like, I think right now people, really want these sorts of things. And even just the thought, even if it's just tweeting out that you did that, I feel like a lot of people would gain from that. And like from my dad's tweet that went semi-viral, someone responded to me and said, I'm about to go and call my parents. My dad died when I was 18, but this made me smile. Like, and that's all these things I didn't expect to come out of like a silly little tweet, you know? So yeah, thanks for going into that, man.
I think life is what's important here. We can talk about entrepreneurship and money and how to gain influence and power and all the things that human beings desire, but I mean, living a happy life is the hard part, right? Money doesn't make people happy. You got to figure out what makes you happy and do more of it.
Talking of which, one of the ones I loved was having kids is underrated, right? And I feel like, you know, most of us want to have kids. A lot of people do. I don't have kids yet, but tell me about that, man. Like, how's that experience changed the way you see the world, you know, before and after having kids? What changed in you?
Yeah. So first of all, I had a really good father. He pumped me up. He told me that he was proud of me. He tells me that he's proud of me all the time. And honestly, when my dad calls me on the phone and tells me that he's proud of me now, like that's more fun than that $2 million cash out refinance was for me. And it means more to me. Like I end up crying and my dad ends up crying. It's awesome. And I just think that we as, you know, humans in the developed world have such an opportunity to create opportunity for our kids and be good parents. And like now never has been, like, there's a lot of negativity. I shield myself from most of it. There's a lot of negativity in the media, but like now is a better time than ever. The quality of life is better than ever. The opportunity is better than ever. And if you're a good parent, you're going to have raise kids that are going to build awesome families and have great relationships with you. That's one part of it. The other part of it, I've been doing a lot of talking with, you know, 50, 60 year olds about, you know, what they're proud of and what they're doing. Every single one of them, every single person that I know that's 60 years old or older, all they care about, all they want to talk about is their kids and their grandkids. And like, I can see it now that I have two kids, I can see it that they delight me. I want to explore with them. I want to learn with them. I want to build memories with them. And like, I know that I want to have a big family so that someday I'm an old man sitting at a fire when I have a coffee in my hand and I'm seeing little grandkids running all over the place and they're saying, Papa, look at this, Papa, look at that. Like that's my dream. That's my dream.
Love it, man. You're going to get me teary eyed. You know, no, I will say that my dad, we just had my nephew now he's like 3 or 4. I don't even know what year we're in right now, but, yeah. So I have a nephew. It's the first one in our family. And my dad told me, and my mom actually, that having grandkids is even better than having kids. And I was like, oh, wow, that's incredible. Something to look forward to. But maybe one, because they're not like figuring out a bunch of stuff. You know, my parents were like 19, 20 something when they had the first kid.
My dad worked a lot. You know, a lot of people's parents work all the time. My goal through all this entrepreneurship is to really from 35 to 45 be retired like a grandparent so I can do everything with my kids.
While you've still got the health and youth on your side too. Just to talk about that a little bit more, I also loved, you talked about the tribe makes the place. And I love this as well because, look, everyone's different. I also do value like being in a certain place that you like, whether that's the climate, the culture of the city, you know, the energy, whatever. So I pay a premium to live in New York and I'm more than happy to do so. But you're completely right. The tribe makes the place. And one of the things our mutual friend Sean Puri said, which I loved, which was he wants to be in a place where he can be like a walking distance from like 5 people that he loves, whether that's friends or family. And I just love that so much because, you know, when you can just get up and walk, and you, right now we're not really taking the train unnecessarily, right? I'm not trying to spend $50 on an Uber to Manhattan for no reason either. So being able to just walk to friends and see them makes such a huge difference to your life. So I'm curious, like, how have you kind of curated that tribe for yourself too?
It's the spontaneity that makes relationships fun. That's what that's period. Like if you're planning things 3 or 4 weeks out, you know, with people from other cities, that's fun. Like getting on a plane and going to a golf trip, that's really fun stuff. You go back to the parent stuff, and there's eight Huber men left in this world. There's 8 men in my lineage with the name Huber left because a lot of them had daughters and their names didn't carry on. They were all in Athens, Georgia for a golf trip with me 2 months ago. And it was one of the best weekends of my life, getting everybody together, and they loved it. They ate it up. So that part of it is fun, like traveling to see people that you're close to. But the spontaneity of, you know, being able to just call a buddy and say, hey, let's go get a beer right now. Or, hey, do you want to get in the car and, you know, drive it into Atlanta to try check out this cigar bar tonight? Or do you want to, like, yeah, I'm coming over. Like, what do you, I don't care what you're doing. I'm coming over to see you. Like, those are the relationships that are fun. And the digital age is just crushing that stuff. I, you know, when I was a kid, the kids would come over and knock on doors and my parents would have friends just stop over. They would just stop over and the kids would get out and they'd come in. And sometimes my parents were a little bit pissed off, but most of the time they were really happy. And I think that college was different for us than it was for my parents. My parents went to the pub at 5 o'clock because that's where everybody met. And then the rest of the day was spontaneous. Hey, do you want to go do this? Do you want to go do that? And when I was in college, people sat in their rooms and drank vodka until 11 p.m. and then met at the bars for 5 minutes. And it was ridiculous.
And they didn't probably remember half of that after that point anyway. Yeah, yeah, actually, I will say one extra point on that, though, is I completely agree with you. And I'm all for like being able to see people in person. Those are the best relationships. But I am conscious of some people growing up in a place where they don't necessarily have that, whether that's a bad household, you know, parents. Both of us are lucky to have great parents who, you know, we liked being around or whatever. But there's some people who don't have that. And then secondly, there are some people who go to school. I've heard you talk about getting bullied. I've had some of that myself as well. And then, and we can go into that in a second. And sometimes your virtual tribe or your tribe isn't what you want, and you have to go and find people and be intentional about that. And when you're like 16 or 15, you don't really have much room to do that because it's all based on proximity, where you live, the school you go to. And I will say there has been, I've seen some amazing communities, especially in the last year, where people of a similar mindset are meeting up on Zoom. I know it's not as good as real life and it's not the spontaneity.
It's pretty darn close. This is a pretty awesome conversation right here.
Yeah, for sure. And you're able to have these conversations with people virtually. And like, I'll give an example, Jack Butcher, who's been on the show now twice, Visualized Value dude. I've never met this guy in person, but me and him text almost every other day, if not every day. And this like kind of sounds a bit weird, but like we just get on so much. And that's because we connected through this conversation first. And then, you know, we start learning each other's like backgrounds. We realize, oh, we're both from the UK. We like the same music as a kid and stuff like that. And there's this sort of connection that I just saw his wife post a picture of 10 years in the US with him. And I was genuinely happy for them, like I would be like one of my best friends who I've known forever. So there are those connections you can make with people.
That is such a good point. I think too many people have friends because of proximity. I mean, first of all, it's a really sad deal to not have good parents. Like if you don't have good parents, you are set up for failure in this world, unfortunately. Mm. Like the school system can only do so much. Education system, you know, it's really, really, really tough. But too many people make too many friends based on proximity. And you can have, I see my world really changing. This Twitter stuff is all coming fast for me. It's new. But I think in 5 years, my 10 best friends, 5 of them will be folks that I met on Twitter, and 5 of them will be folks that I go see once or twice a year and we have an amazing weekend together. And I think those will be my people. Those will be the people that care about business and life and getting better and entrepreneurship. It's really hard to find 5 people that live near you that are into the same stuff you're into. I'm into very unique stuff. Obviously, completely. You talk to me, I'm a very unique person. So finding a neighbor that cares about business like I do, that cares about getting better like I do, that, you know, it's just different. So I wholeheartedly agree with you that, hey, make some friends in other parts of the country and reap amazing rewards from doing that.
Yeah, 100%, man. Amen to that, brother. Because I feel the same, like the way I have these conversations. Let's say me and you spoke over Twitter and said, let's meet for coffee or whatever. And you happen to be in the city or I come upstate. Like we might have a great conversation, but there's actually something amazing about our first real interaction face to face, if you want to say that, is me being able to ask you about your childhood. And to, you know, if I met you in person, I probably wouldn't ask half these questions, right? So there's a kind of layer that you break down. And by the time now I text you next week or we talk about whatever, there's probably going to be a different sort of early relationship that's built because of these conversations too. So that's another thing I'd say to people is sometimes you need to be proactive about going to find either those communities or people you want to build relationships with. And in full transparency, the number one reason I do this show is to do this, like to have an amazing conversation, to build up those 5-10 people that I want to spend more time with virtually or in person, because those relationships compound over time. The knowledge compounds over time as well, and the experiences and the fun times compound over time. So that's kind of the number one reason. And if I optimize for that and don't care about, oh, did 10 people will listen to this or a million people, like, yeah, I want to optimize for that at some point. But really, if I do this, the output will follow for sure. So
that is an awesome way to do it. Yeah, I've had a similar rewarding experience from my podcast. And yeah, the relationship, finding a way to break these barriers down early on in a relationship with somebody pays dividends. Definitely.
100%, man. We're going to wrap up soon-ish. I did have a couple more just to round us out on a similar vein. But before we go on to finish off on a high, we did talk about bullying there. And again, this is just, you seem like a pretty honest, open guy, and so am I. So let's talk a little bit about that, because a lot of people listening to this have a chip on their shoulder. They've gone through bad experiences, maybe trauma, depending on how bad it was. If you don't mind me asking, like, do you feel any like pain or like residue from those experiences being bullied when you were younger?
It stuck with me for a little while. Yeah, I just think that, you know, there's nothing in this world more cruel than a fourth grade to 10th grade human being. And it takes away they don't have that feeling of emotional pain that they've caused. And they also have this status game where they act like apes, and it's their job to knock others down and pull people down and get to the top. And these status games, I mean, part of it is just finding somebody weak and being mean to them to make yourself feel better. And the other part of it is finding somebody strong and trying to prove that you're stronger than them. So, you know, half of the time I was being, you know, given a rough time to the kids that were below me. And half of the time the kids that, and I was never cruel, like the kids were cruel to me, but it's a crazy cycle, man. And I think a lot of it was that I moved to the school and I was good at sports, and, you know, they felt threatened and just demolished me and made my life fucking hell for 3 years probably. So yeah, that shit sticks with you.
Yeah, for sure, man. And I'll just share as well, like, I've talked about this recently on someone else's podcast that I was on. And for me, it was like racism. Like, and I went to a school and I'm not definitely someone who likes to even use that word when it's definitely not, but this was like blatant racism, like spitting on you, go home, like get out of our country. And I'm like, I was born 10 minutes from here, you know, stuff like that, especially after 9/11. My name's Mohammed on paper as well. But you know, those things happen, and, you know, maybe it made me who I am for sure. But it takes time to not have that. When you're in relationships, when you're going into the workforce, you don't even realize until much later that you're trying to prove yourself. You're trying to make up for that bad comment someone said when you were 11 years old. You know, you don't even remember it. It's deep in your psyche. And the only way to do that is, one, to reflect and to try to think about it. Two is, you know, maybe for someone that's going to therapists and talking it through properly, sometimes it's just sharing, whether that's a journal yourself or talking to a friend. Now I'm definitely at peace with a lot of that stuff, but for a long time, man, that drove me in a way that was probably not natural. Because if you met me when I was 21, I was the most motivated person you ever meet in your life. I was like fired up. I was going to take over the world, and I still have an element of that in me, but I'm a little bit more like, I'm putting it in its place. I'm like, okay, that a lot of that's coming from me trying to prove myself. Now I don't really feel like I'm trying to prove myself. I'm just trying to live. I'm just trying to enjoy.
Yeah, I found myself being a very cocky 18 to 24 year old. That's for sure. Arrogant. Rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Yeah.
And that's something, if you're in that age group, you might have felt something similar. And some people are 55 and never got over it and even thought about it. So I think it's important to bring up.
My father, they say daddy issues as a joke, but that's a big deal for a lot of my friends and a lot of people that I talk to. And luckily, that whole time, I thought my dad was the biggest badass in the world, and he was building me up. So getting that confirmation was amazing. But yeah, there's guys who will break down in tears. These guys make $400,000, $500,000 a year, and they break down in tears because their father never said that they were proud of them.
Yeah, completely. Mm-hmm. The last one for you here, man, is about your spouse. I know you've got kids, you've been married.
Yeah, married in 2016.
So talk to me about that, because I feel like that's something that doesn't really get acknowledged enough almost is how important your partner, spouse, wife, husband is.
I feel pretty strongly about this. I'll riff on it because I think 50% of people, probably more, 50% of the people I know, and I'm pretty have high standards of who I let in, are pretty overall pretty negative people. They complain, they gossip, they talk about what's going wrong. And that is very, very, very contagious. And it weighs on your head, it weighs on your mind, it weighs on your soul, and it weighs on your productivity. And the other part of it is a lot of people get sort of jealous, and they're looking out for themselves. They're a little bit selfish. And if you can find a spouse that's neither one of those things, that is not a negative person, but a positive person, and is not a, you know, has these issues about trust or, you know, obviously I think if one of it's, if you cheat on your spouse early on in a relationship, you're screwed because you can never build that back. And me and my wife luckily have never experienced that with each other, but my goal is to make her the best version of herself, and her goal is to make me the best version of myself. And it's a true goal. It's not something that we just talk about. So it works out so much better. And also, as an entrepreneur, if you are an adventurer like me, always taking chances, having a spouse that can go through stressful situations without the world collapsing. I have really good friends that just, that emotional tick when something goes wrong is really hard to suppress. And like when the kids are screaming or when you're on an airplane and they're having a meltdown, being able to keep your cool is not easy. But unfortunately, life, especially life with kids and life being married to an entrepreneur, it's a roller coaster. So having somebody who's even keel and can keep a level head and not burst during stressful times is absolutely critical.
Are there things that you feel like you've learned as you've got older or more mature that have helped you maintain that throughout the relationship? Because, you know, a lot of people listen to this are struggling in the relationship, so don't have one. But let's just say for those who are in relationships, are there things that you two do that really keep that balance and keep you focused on making each other the best version of yourselves?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things. It's do as I say, not as I do, because nobody's perfect at this stuff. Yeah. But it just takes so much work. I mean, you literally have to treat it like anything else in life, and you have to work at it. You have to work at it. You have to have intimate conversations. You have to be vulnerable for sure and communicate that stuff. And if you're not working at it and you're not, the honeymoon phase wears off well before a lot of people get married nowadays, right? So like that's not going to last forever. You have to be a partnership that works together on that stuff. And it's hard. It's not easy. Having a good, healthy marriage, a happy marriage is something that very few people, very, very, very few people accomplish.
Yeah, I don't know if I can count on two hands the amount of people who I know who are even in happy relationships long term, and the ones who are, I feel like they probably seem like the sort of people who are self-aware enough where they know that they're probably pushing the boundaries too much at times, and they kind of bring themselves back in. But it's easier said than done.
Too many men, especially, you know, I don't know what your demographics are here, but too many men, they get this arrogance, especially after they make money. Me and my wife met and I was broke. She carried us for the first several years, but now we're making real money. And it's easy for me to feel like, okay, I can be an asshole. I can be arrogant. I can tell her that she needs to do this and tell her that she needs to do that. And you can't do that shit. You really can't. You have to keep respecting somebody and you have to humble yourself. You can't be an arrogant asshole or your marriage is going to suck.
Yeah. And I think it's important to acknowledge that you built it together, because it's not just the business, it's your home, it's your family, it's the support for each other, all the late night talks you have about like this stressful thing. Like without that, it's very difficult to do. So love this, man. So listen, the last thing, just to wrap up here, I love the way you ended this amazing tweet storm. You said, "I'm just a guy and nothing I say should be blindly followed or taken as fact," which I think is important to acknowledge. But this one really kind of capped it off, which was, "There's never been a time of more rapid change for so many people. As an opportunist, you have a choice. Are you going to capitalize, add value, and make a name for yourself? Are you going to start taking steps to lead to a better life? Or are you going to sit back and watch?" And I think that's a great way to finish this off, because, you know, all the things that we've just discussed there, look, you've broken down the real estate game at a level I've never heard, you know, and people can do what they want with that. And the second part is also all these amazing ideas of the way we both see the world and that discussion. You know, people can take what they want from that. But is there anything you'd want to ask from people listening, you know, have you got a message for them? Is there anything you'd like to share before we wrap up?
So I've softened my opinion on this. I mean, I used to be an extreme ownership, Jocko Willink, kind of like, you need to take control of what's going on. I understand that that's a privileged thing to say. It's easy for me as a white male who grew up to two loving parents, who now has influence and money and power. It's easy for me to sit back on in my house and say that. Very easy. But on the other hand, it's the only way to make your situation better. That mindset, far too many folks, and I see people who have the world at their fingertips that do this. They complain, nothing's their fault, nothing is up to them, life is really hard. The bottom line is life is fucking hard for everybody. Life is hard for everybody. And, you know, you really have to say, okay, things have got tough for everybody. Okay, things are changing. You have a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of way to look at it. And if you capitalize, if you think, okay, when things change, that means there's opportunity. And that's a true fact, period. When things change, there's opportunity to add value somewhere. It doesn't have to be money value. It can be life-changing value. It can be whatever. But, you know, you have an opportunity. Are you going to sit back and complain and blame politicians and blame, you know, other people? Or are you going to say, all right, what is something in my control that I can do right now to make things better for me and my kids and their kids and their kids? And there's almost always something. There's almost always something you can do. And more energy needs to go to that than feeling sorry for yourself. But again, that's such a privileged thing to say.
No, and I completely agree, man. I think that's what this whole podcast is about, is trying to help people make their own decisions and give them some tools and frameworks and experiences and stories to push themselves forward. So of course, there's a bunch of things you don't control, but if you can focus on what you do control, you're probably in a position to at least improve from the place that you're in. So
life begins at the end of your comfort zone. You really have to get out of the comfort zone, and that's what most people are afraid of doing. It's uncomfortable to do anything worth doing, anything, to build a relationship, to put yourself out there on Twitter, to start a company, to go for a big job, to try to get a spouse that you think is amazing. All of it is uncomfortable. And if you're stuck in your comfort zone, you're going to live an average to poor life.
100%, man. Listen, brother, this has been incredible. Really enjoyed this. Where can we send people? We've got at Sweaty Startup on Twitter. You've also got the podcast, and you've got this course coming up as well. So when's that coming out so people can check it out?
Yeah, first of all, Bilal, you're awesome at this, man.
Thank you, man.
This is phenomenal. I have not experienced anybody do this well at hitting me in all my sweet spots, researching what's going on, and also just asking, you know, having an in-depth, awesome conversation, man.
I appreciate it, man.
But yeah, you can email me, nick@sweatystartup.com if you want. I have a website, sweatystartup.com, and then on Twitter @sweatystartup. I have a real estate course that's not for everybody. It's for people who are serious about it with some cash. If you're into personal development and getting a little bit better, that's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about nowadays.
No, I appreciate the kind words, man. And yeah, you made it easy with how much great stuff you've put out there. But that's all I try to do, is make sure I'm prepared enough that we can have a good conversation. And I'm glad you enjoyed it too. So yeah, we'll be in touch. And if you listen to this, keep spreading the word and sharing this with friends. I think people are going to absolutely love this one. So would love your thoughts. You can tweet both of us at Twitter as well. That's where I'm spending most of my time online as well. And yeah, speak to you soon.
I love your work. Thanks for everything.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm @bzaidi, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.